What are Illinois communities doing to confront violence, and is it enough?
I always think that race matters. I think it's a topic that a lot of people don't really want to talk about. I like to call it truthful dialogue. You know, sometimes it might not be what you want to hear, but also I think in the end, it just makes us a more progressive, better community.
We speak with one member of a community group in Decatur that's trying to work between police and communities. And as the GOP convention continues in Cleveland...
Here at this convention and our 2016 field, it was the most diverse and youngest presidential field in American history. Who is the party of youth and diversity? We are the party of youth and diversity, not the Democrats.
We talked to the young man from Wheeling who made that speech on the floor yesterday. That and more coming up on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The Republican National Convention is in its second day in Cleveland. Yesterday, we saw some big names speak, including former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani, Texas Governor Rick Perry, and Donald Trump's wife, Melania Trump. And earlier in the day, a 22-year-old from suburban Chicago.
We have the only sitting U.S. senator under the age of 40. We have the youngest Speaker of the House since 1868 in Paul Ryan. We have three governors under the age of 50, Governor Scott Walker, Governor Matt Bevin, Governor Nikki Haley. We have the two only Indian American governors in Bobby Jindal and Nikki Haley. We have nine U.S. senators under the age of 50. We have the youngest woman ever elected to Congress in Elise Stefanik. Who is the party of youth and diversity? We are the party of youth and diversity, not the Democrats.
That was yesterday in Cleveland. Charlie Kirk joins us now from there. He's the founder and executive director of Turning Point USA, that group's based in Lamont in suburban Chicago. Hey, Charlie, welcome to the 21st.
Hey, thanks so much for having me. Glad to be here.
Yeah, what kind of response did you get to your speech yesterday?
Really positive. I had a lot of people on social media, Twitter and Facebook, and also in person throughout the convention saying, you know, thank you for saying that. That's a stigma that we run into, frequently. Obviously, at the convention, a lot of Republicans that probably are very vocal about their support of the Republican Party. And I understand that one of the biggest talking points in opposition to the Republican Party is comprised of rich old white men, and so kind of the theme of my speech, which wasn't very long, but I think I packed a lot of material in there in a short period of time, was that actually our party is rather uniquely diverse and young. If you look at it in a historical trend, we're shattering glass ceilings left and right, and I think it's something that at least the American people should be notified and understand. And I don't like identity politics. I don't like saying, oh, we have the first this and first that, but unfortunately we have to, as the Republican Party, start talking about that, because that is the pretense that a lot of people use to attack.
Well, and Charlie, yeah, your notion, right, that the Republican Party is a party of old, rich white men. I feel like I do have to state, and pardon the pun of the elephant in the room, but I think it's that, I don't know if it's necessarily a stigma, but I think many Americans don't see the GOP as being a party of diversity. And the one thing that I think everyone that comes to mind right away is you mentioned Paul Ryan, and I think he was criticized recently of his Instagram of all of his interns when he put up this picture, look at all my interns, and I think there was one person of color in the picture, and I think people think that's the Republican Party.
Right.
Why do you disagree? Yeah.
Yeah, I disagree greatly. So let's look. I mean, the Democrats fielded four candidates this year, four candidates. All of them were white, and there was one woman, and all of them were over the age of 65. That's not exactly a young, diverse party, whereas the Republican Party, they fielded two Latinos, only four Latinos ever run for president of the United States. The Republican Party this cycle had the first Latino ever to win a presidential preference primary caucus in the history of the United States. The Republican Party this year had the first Indian American ever to run for president of the United States in Bobby Jindal. The Republican Party this year fielded one of the only African Americans ever to run for president of the United States. Obviously, Barack Obama and Jesse Jackson did in years subsequent, but that's still a big landmark and accomplishment.
But I guess what people
never run for president.
Sure.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I think that people would say, but the old white guy is probably the one who's going to get the nomination. I mean, Donald Trump is the presumptive.
Well, let's look at the final. I mean, the final three was Rubio, Cruz, and Trump. That's two Latinos, Kasich. I mean, but you have two Latinos and two white people. I mean, so, but the point being is that the media more times than not. And I hear this all the time on the ground and Twitter and Facebook amongst young people, professors, whatever we want to name, you know, the blame for it. But it is a soundbite that is used a lot against Republicans. And so I felt in my short period of time at the Republican convention to use the time that I was allotted to try to break that misconception that actually there's a lot of glass ceilings that are being broken by the Republican Party. And it's not just a bunch of old rich white guys. It's actually a party of youth and diversity.
And are you seeing that, Charlie? That yeah. Are you seeing that at the convention? Are you seeing a lot of youth and diversity at the
RNC?
No,
I mean, because you have a lot of delegates here that, of course, are running from you to be a delegate. It's an incredibly complicated and sometimes expensive process. And to get a pass in the RNC, it's very cumbersome. So I don't like any of these stories that are saying, like, oh, you know, the convention is full of a bunch of old white people. Well, I mean, well, first and foremost, it's incredibly difficult to become a delegate, to run for delegate. I wanted to run for delegate in Illinois, and I missed filing deadlines and meetings I just couldn't be there for. So it's understandable that people that are retired or in more affluent areas do become delegates to the Republican National Committee that are of older nature. But I do see more times than not that, yeah, the leadership in our party is becoming more diverse and more young, and I would actually put it back on the Democrats. I mean, Nancy Pelosi is 76. That's not exactly young. Harry Reid is in his mid-70s. That's not very young. I mean, so I think it's a terrible misconception to just throw this label that the Republicans are the only one that are these rich old white guys trying to control your future. And, you know, I have to say, I hear that way more times than I think I'd like to admit.
Let's talk apart from leadership. Let's talk about what you're seeing with your organization, and maybe as you've pointed out, the RNC and the convention itself isn't necessarily the best place to talk about the party and what the party represents. I wanted to ask you about Donald Trump. Do you, as someone who's promoting diversity within the Republican Party, do you think that having Donald Trump as the nominee, does that help with?
No, I don't think so, and I'm not a huge Donald Trump fan. I'll probably end up voting for him, and I've been pretty vocal about that. I mean, I've had a lot of hesitations and trepidation about putting him at the top of the ticket. I mean, I don't think his rhetoric or his language necessarily is one that will, you know, diversify the party further or will broaden the base or make our party more youth-oriented. I will say this, though. I think that the Republican Party is losing an opportunity in some sense, because I think if we would have nominated someone like a Marco Rubio or a Ted Cruz, I think the contrast against Hillary Clinton would have been very stark and immense. Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump are two very negatively perceived characters in the public sphere. But no, I'm not a huge Donald Trump fan by any means, and I've been kind of vocal on that. And I think that the more he talks about just economic freedom and, you know, free markets, those sorts of issues, I just think earlier in the cycle he might have said some things that are going to be very, very hard to recover from. Mm. Yeah, I mean, I totally admit that. I mean, putting him at the top of the ticket is not the best person to try to diversify the party or make it more young. I mean, I will concede that wholeheartedly.
Well, let's talk about you. This is actually your second. You're 22, but this is the second convention you've attended, right?
That's correct.
So yep. How old? So you were, well, were you 18 for the first?
I was 18. Yep, went to the convention in Tampa, Florida. That's
and
right.
How did that happen?
Well, kind of fell backwards into that. That's kind of where Turning Point USA, the organization, I met some people that actually ended up helping get the organization off the ground. I flew down there with really no ticket, no media credentials, nothing, and met some people that were generous enough to give me like half a day pass, and met some other, you know, really generous, nice people that opened up a lot of doors. And so the convention this year looks a lot different for me than it was 4 years ago. 4 years ago, I was just trying to meet people and try to make a name for myself. This year, I'm all credentialed and badged up and a little bit different. We've progressed greatly as an organization.
And so Turning Point, right, your organization, Turning Point USA, focuses on, I think, is your tagline, big government sucks?
That's one of them, yeah.
Okay.
Big government sucks, free markets, free people. We organize college and high school students around the values of free markets and limited government. We're nonprofits, so we're not political. But obviously, you know, myself taking time here, there's a lot of individuals that have a propensity to have interest and support in the work that we're doing. And there is obviously some overlap between the general objectives of the Republican Party trying to accomplish economic freedom and what we're trying to do on the grassroots level.
What are you hoping to get out of the convention, Charlie?
Well, I know a lot of friends here, meeting a lot of great people, trying to meet new supporters, potential donors, doing a lot of different media interviews, and just trying to have some fun. I mean, this is the Super Bowl of politics every 4 years. I mean, it just brings out people that you'll never get to see all at one time in one place. I have some of my best relationships and closest friends and allies here at this convention. I suggest to anyone who really isn't involved in politics with a great passion for it, even if you disagree with the, you know, person at the top of ticket or you have some exception to the way the party is running, you know, it's worth your time. It's incredible. Every media asset out is here. People from all over the world come. So it's really a once in every 4 year opportunity.
Charlie, one last question for you. As you are, you know, you're 22, obviously youth, diversity are issues that are really important to you for the Republican Party. Where would you like to see the future of the party go?
Yeah, I'd love to see us go and try to promote our young leaders even further. I would have loved to have seen us this cycle nominate someone under the age of 50. I think that would have been just a great step. But we didn't make that happen. I'd like to see us embrace issues that young people really care about that can kind of soften the brand and the image of the Republican Party. A great one would be criminal justice reform. I think young people are in broad agreement to that. I don't think the Democrats should have a monopoly on that particular issue.
And certainly there's been bipartisan agreement from that in Washington.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you see the Koch brothers and the Soros Foundation agreeing on something, which is quite rare, and I would love to see the Republican Party embrace issues like that, right, and champion it on the national stage. My guess is in this convention we're not going to hear a lot about that, but that's to be understood. And so I'd like to see our party and our generation start find more agreement on issues like economic freedom and individual liberty and start to talk about the importance of balancing budgets and making people the champions of their own destinies and, you know, restoring freedom for the younger generation, which I think is the most important issue. And I've been very vocal about this, but I personally consider myself a social conservative, but I think some of the social issues are very divisive and do us more harm than good, especially in the eyes of younger voters and people that are just trying to turn around to be a Republican voter for the first time. And polls have shown on local level, obviously we saw it here in Illinois, we've seen it in Wisconsin, that when gubernatorial candidates run on issues of cutting taxes and balancing budgets, they do a lot better than if they're running on social agendas. And we saw the consequences of that for positive and negative here, you know, obviously in Illinois with Rauner and Walker in Wisconsin. And for negative, if you look at Murdoch in Indiana in 2012 and Aiken in 2012 in Missouri, they lost because they ran a purely kind of social agenda campaign. So you can see the contrast there, and I'd love to see our party embrace more of a kind of free market, free people type message, which I think could really broaden the appeal for young people in particular.
That's Charlie Kirk. He's the founder and executive director of Turning Point USA. As you said, he's one of the Illinois folks who were in Cleveland, as you heard him say. Charlie, thanks for taking the time to join us.
Yeah, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Joining us now, as Charlie said, all the media that's at the RNC, our own Amanda Vinicky. Of course, she's Illinois Public Radio State House Bureau Chief. She's been reporting from the convention all week and will be there at the she'll be at the Democratic National Convention as well. Hey, Amanda, welcome back to the 21st.
Good afternoon, Nyla.
What's the atmosphere like right now?
Well, right now, you basically have, I'm trying to get some stories done. We have delegates from Illinois heading off to an event at the Great Lakes Luncheon at the Cleveland Yachting Club. So cocktails and such on the horizon, but later today you'll have the delegation taking to the floor, and this is where the actual nominating process gets underway. And so that is what is ahead. You have a lot of, frankly, really excited Trump delegates, many of whom are new to the process, first-time delegates, and so this is all exciting and, I think eye-opening for many of them.
Amanda's joining us on her cell. Amanda, if you can stay where you are, because it sounds like you're breaking up a little. I know you're on the floor and running all over in Cleveland. I wanted to ask you, we were just talking to Charlie Kirk. He's not a delegate. He's 22. He has an organization where, as he said, kind of one is it's very pro-free market. As he said, big government sucks. Like, is this, I wanted to ask about the RNC. Is this a place where young people like Charlie have a chance to, you know, he was actually addressed the convention floor. It was like for 2 minutes. But do we also get the chance to see younger people like him also at this convention?
You know, you see really an array of people. It is fascinating to just walk around the convention hall itself and nearby where you have, of course, protesters, be it Code Pink, people that are dressed in flashy, glittery dresses, be it a delegate from Texas, where every day generally you'll have the Texas delegation wear matching outfits.
They all wear matching? Like what? What do they wear?
Basically, yesterday at least, was red and blue long sleeve collared shirts with jeans, many cowboy boots.
It's like lots of buckles.
Cowboy
buckles.
Hats.
Yeah. Okay.
Point being, you really see a little bit of everything, including, yes, there are most definitely some youngsters. And part of that is because, as Charlie just talked about, they're elected locally. And particularly in Illinois, you did have the Trump campaign because it was run unorthodox. There were a lot of questions early on. Not only were there thoughts that he wouldn't be able to be the nominee because of perhaps he didn't have any political background, but because his campaign was run in such a different way that there just wasn't the machine operation. So surely that brought some new individuals into the fold. That said, I would say that when you look at the Illinois delegation, they may be newcomers, but it is by and large a group of, you know, middle-aged or over and very largely, pretty much all white, frankly. And I don't know the breakdown of females to males, but maybe an evenish split there, but it is not what one would presumably perceive to be a diverse delegation.
Okay, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Amanda Vinicky. She's been on the floor of the RNC reporting from Cleveland for us all week as part of the IPR team that's there. When we come back, we've been talking about the delegates. We're going to talk about the big story today, Melania Trump's speech. Also yesterday, Ohio Governor John Kasich addressing the Illinois delegation. How that went. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Welcome back to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're talking about the RNC going on right now in Cleveland. Our IPR Bureau, State House Bureau Chief Amanda Vinicky has been there reporting all week, and she's on the line with us. Amanda, we were talking about the Illinois delegation before the break. What's the Illinois Republican Party chairman? I know you've been in contact. What's sort of the what's the feedback? What kind of things are you hearing from the Illinois Republican Party these first 2 days of the convention?
Well, I mean, they're really trying to present a united front. As you and I just spoke about, there are a lot of newcomers here. So we've really been trying to get a feel for how they're being brought into the fold, whether they're liking it or not. There are a couple that appear to be more suspicious of the establishment. But by and large, you talk to the delegates, and as I said, eye-opening and really feeling like they said a lot of inclusion to the party. There were conference calls before this convention, a trip to Springfield, the state party convention in May, and a lot of enthusiasm, frankly, for Donald Trump. You know, I've been trying to talk to people, do you think he has a chance in Illinois and why? And the delegates themselves are pumped about it. That said, we heard, for example, this morning from a pair of congressmen, Randy Holgren and also Peter Roskam. Peter Roskam not willing to say yet if or give an actual endorsement to Donald Trump. There remains trepidation. And so Roskam says, you know, better choice than Hillary Clinton, but not willing to fully get on the, quote, Trump train.
Well, and we saw all of the movement yesterday, a little chaotic on the floor when there was an attempt to change the rules in a vote. And these were sort of the Never Trump folks who were trying to make one last stand on the floor of the convention. Interestingly, that was happening the same time Ohio Governor John Kasich was actually addressing a lunch for the Illinois delegation. And I know that there was some feedback from some of the Illinois delegates that maybe they thought that was deliberate to keep them off the floor. Is that what?
Yeah, I think that was just really a couple. I don't think that has not been a widespread sentiment by any means, although it is telling about just in general how these conventions work. You know, the part that is on the news in the evening, those are the primetime speeches, the real headliners, where they try to bring in the big celebrities and all of the media is focused on that. But you have full days of activities, and some members of the delegations go to the convention hall and take part in any platform meetings or discussions on policy. Those are going on, but really, most of what delegates spend their day doing is something akin to the Kasich event at a steakhouse yesterday, where as I noted, the delegation right now off to a yacht club. Then they have a cocktail reception, and there's a lot of mingling, getting to know one another, and you know, you have sponsored events by lobbyists. That's really a lot of what goes on during the day. To get back to kind of the politics of the things, again, where you get to this divide between the Trump delegates and the establishment. That remains, and I think Kasich is a real key case in point there. He talked about Bruce Rauner, says that he'll be coming to Illinois to help out Rauner, and also U.S. Senator Mark Kirk. You can't forget that neither the governor or Senator Kirk are going to the RNC at all. They are steering clear. Kirk has said that he isn't going to vote for Donald Trump, and Kasich at that Illinois event didn't talk at all about Trump. And in fact, he, the governor of the state where this RNC is being hosted, was called out yesterday by Trump's campaign manager. So there really is not a full cohesive Republican Party at this point in time, I think it's fair to say.
Yeah, there's so much going on. Really quickly, Amanda, I wonder, what are we looking for? What should people be paying attention to tonight or tomorrow at the convention?
For tonight's event is Making America Work Again. Yesterday was all about safety, so you'll hear a lot about the economy and the plans that Donald Trump has for fixing that.
Amanda Vinicky is with Illinois Public Radio. You can hear her reports later this evening, tomorrow morning, all hours, as she's working very hard for us in Cleveland. Amanda, thanks for taking the time.
Thank you.
You know, yesterday, and Amanda alluded to this, we talked about how this year's presidential race, at least according to the polls, has been more polarizing than usual. That's when you measure negative ratings, not just for Donald Trump, but for Hillary Clinton. And it's sort of this idea of whether or not a third party candidate has been gaining support. We asked you for your comments on this issue. We got this voicemail yesterday from Amy sharing her thoughts on it.
I am absolutely considering voting for a third party candidate, and I thought I would never do so. All my life, people have said a third-party candidate will never win the presidency. It's just not possible. Well, I remember a year ago, people saying Trump will never get the Republican nomination. It just isn't possible. Well, I guess anything is possible, and I have read as much as I can on Gary Johnson, and I am seriously considering giving him my vote.
You can always leave us a voicemail. Our hotline is 217-300-2121. You can find our whole conversation online about third-party candidates. We'll tweet out that link. We've been talking in recent weeks about issues involving race, police, and violence. It's been a national conversation. And in the middle of that, last week in Decatur, police shot and wounded a black man. He had what police described as a realistic-looking BB gun. It's still under investigation. We don't know many of the details. What we do know is that shortly after that shooting, Decatur police activated the community's ALERT team. That stands for Area Leaders Educators Response Team. We're going to be talking with a member of that team in just a minute. We know that cities across Illinois have been working to confront some of these issues for years, and we wanted to talk about what they're doing and what needs to happen next. Today, we're starting in Decatur. If you're part of Community Conversations on Race where you live, what are you hearing? Join us right now. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet to 21st Show. What conversations are you having? What conversations do you think we should be having? Our phone number again, 1-800-222-9455. Jeffrey Perkins founded Caring Black Men of Decatur. He's also part of that ALERT response team and joins us on the phone from his home in Decatur. Jeffrey, welcome to the 21st. Thank you for taking the time to speak with us.
Yes, good morning. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. As part of that ALERT team, when did you find out about the shooting that happened last week?
Well, actually, I found out about it a Monday morning around 3:45. We have a phone tree, and the person called me.
3:45 a.m.
I'm sorry, yes.
Yeah, I just wanted to make that clear for everyone. Sorry to interrupt. Go ahead.
3:45 a.m., which was like 2.5 hours after the shooting, and was informed that there had been a shooting and that it was going to be a press release at the police department at 6 a.m. So I was there at 6 a.m. to be a part of that press release.
And what's the role of the alert team? What role are you all supposed to be playing within the community?
Well, actually, you know, we're the first to receive information. The police are supposed to be as transparent as possible without getting into the investigation of what actually happened, which that's what they did. And so then it's our job, supposedly, to go back as a member of the community, to go back and talk with people to kind of let them know what's going on, that things did happen. The police are looking into it, trying to give them as much information as we can, without, you know, again, without getting into the investigation. So basically that's the idea of the alert team. I think the real work is after that to go out into the community and actually talk with people about things that are going on in their lives, because when things like this happen, a lot of times people protest and the violence comes around because they're upset about so many things, not necessarily just the issue that happened with the shooting. And so I think to get some feel for, in our case here in Decatur, a lot of our young people are real frustrated and things are going on in their lives, their relationship with the police department. So, you know, do a little legwork up front and try to talk with them about how things should be handled, get some feelings of where they're coming from, which we did at a rally at the Macon County building that next day, and to let, you know, let them vent and voice their frustrations.
Yeah, Jeffrey. Well, you were talking about the work after the shooting, so I imagine that as you all are playing this role as liaison, there's probably an awful lot of work you have to do before as well, because you're a liaison. You're in a position where you want to be someone that everybody within the community trusts. What groundwork do you need to do in the community before there's a shooting or some sort of event indicator? What kind of things have you all been doing?
Well, again, for myself personally, what I've done is I've just been, you know, working in the community for quite a few years. And I think to be on this team, you have to, as you said earlier, you have to be able to have trust, have people have trust in you, and have built a rapport with a lot of different people in the community. And so, you know, part of mine is with Caring Black Men, that I founded about 8 years ago, that we go into the schools and we talk with our young men, kindergarten all the way to 12th grade, and we talk to them about character and integrity. And in this case, one of the pillars of character is citizenship, and not only citizenship within the schools, but also citizenship in the community. And so we've been talking with the young men for, you know, about 8 years now about those things. And so I think when you have that rapport with young people, and you have a rapport. I was a past president of the NAACP. I was president of a housing organization that provided housing for low to moderate income families. So all those things, I think, help, you know, with the people having trust in me, so when I come back and talk with them about what's happened with this issue or any other issue, that, you know, the trust is already there. So, you know, the legwork is done, like you said, even before things happen, and you hope things that don't happen, but, you know, in this case it did. And so I think I would like to feel that, you know, people do trust me, and I think it's because of the work that I've done in the community.
And obviously that trust needs to extend not just within the community but outside the community, and I want to get to that, to the police and to that side. But let's just stay in the community for a moment and ask about, as you said, you have a long history. Do you think that that trust is something that takes years to develop? How hard is it to develop those relationships and maintain those within a community?
You know, I think it's just, you know, being consistent in what you do. When people, you know, it's not necessarily what you say, it's what they see you do. And when they see you, I'm in the community all the time, you know, in the parks, at events. And so I think when people actually see you do the work, you know, a lot of people give talk, but it's about the walk. And I think that in my case, I'm always there. My wife and I both, my wife is president of the school board. And so we're just in the community. And so I think that it doesn't happen overnight. When trust and building rapport with someone does not happen overnight, especially with our young people. But even in the community also, with our young people, they're very mistrustful. They look at you and they say, well, why? I know the first question we were asked is,
they're mistrustful of you.
Yes. It just says, you know, because they felt like Caring Black Men, well, who are you? Our very first session we had at Eisenhower High School, they looked at us and the very first question a young man asked us was, are you getting paid? So they thought the only reason we would come there to talk to them and mentor them
was like a racket.
Somebody must be paying us, or we were working under a grant or something like that. And that was just not true. And so we had, you know, over the years, we've had to work against that, because in their lives, people come in and out, but generally because someone's paying them to come do something and not because they really care about them. And so with our name, Caring Black Men, we explain to them, we care about you, and that's why we're here.
Now that you are working with the police, and let's be clear, this alert team was put together by groups, not just the police department, but the NAACP and others. Do you feel that that helps or hinders having trust within the community now that you're playing this role and being sort of, I don't know if liaison is the right word, but between the police and helping open communication channels? Do you think that makes it difficult?
You know what? I think it places us in a precarious position because I have to be sure as an individual that I'm getting good information from the police department. You know, a lot of times there's a lot of mistrust because people believe police investigate themselves, and so that's where the mistrust comes in. So here I am in the middle, being able to get the information and be able to come out to the community and say, this is going on and this has happened. And so it does put us in a funny situation. But I'm just hoping that, I'm there to make sure that the process is followed, that I'm getting good information. And if I'm not getting good information and I see something that's not being followed properly, I will be the first to tell, the community the same. So it's really, it's hard. But yet I think if police and community are going to work together, we both have to be able to take criticism. And I think sometimes it's been difficult for police departments around the nation to take criticism when they have things that don't go right within their departments, as the same as in our community with our young people, when they get guns off the street, their activities and different things like that. So it's going to take both of us. When you're in the middle, it's not easy, but I think you have to, as an individual, you have to decide, am I getting good information? And then am I going to be able to convey that back to the community?
And do you feel like at this moment you are getting good information from the police department in Decatur?
Well, so far, I have no reason not to think so. Again, we don't know what's happened in, until an investigation, and it's with the Illinois State Police now, until the investigation is over with. I've been told that initially there was a shooting. Of course, the rumor was that somebody was shot, a black man was shot and killed. Then we find out, no, he was not dead. And then you also find out that he didn't really have a real gun, but he had a BB gun. So those things were conveyed the minute we found out. It was conveyed to the community that those things had happened. So right now, that's kind of where we're at. We don't really know anything else because no one's releasing any other information. So everything that we know, actually, the media and the community, they also know. So actually, we're in a holding pattern and trying to wait to see what happens. But in the meantime, I'm out with a lot of other people in the community talking with young people to say, okay, what's going to happen when the investigation is over and the results come in? What do we do then? If they're favorable to you or unfavorable, what are we going to do? And so I think that's where you really do the most valuable work, is preparing for the investigation to come in with the results and then see what we're going to say.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Jeffrey Perkins as part of Community Conversations on Race. We're going to talk to him a little bit more about how this alert team was founded and a little bit more about what people in Decatur are doing to handle violence within their communities. Thanks for Jeffrey. If you can hold on just a minute, you're listening to The 21st, and we'll continue this conversation in just a minute.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for tuning into the 21st. We're talking about race, police, and violence. It's not just a national conversation. It's happening across communities in Illinois. We know that, and this isn't a conversation that's not just happening in Decatur, where we've been focused on today, but in Springfield and Bloomington Normal and Peoria. We're going to be having those conversations in communities on the 21st. We're starting today with Decatur, and we're speaking with Jeffrey Perkins. He's my guest. He's the founder of Caring Black Men of Decatur. He serves on the Area Leaders Educators Response Team. That's the alert team in Decatur. We were talking about the incident that happened with police, the shooting of one black man last week. And Jeffrey, as we're talking about this, as you're talking about the trust that's needed, what strikes me is, for your part, you have been having these conversations in Decatur for years. And I wanted to ask, what was the event that led you really feeling like we need to be having open and honest conversations in Decatur about this?
Well, I will say not only with Caring Black Men, but also around 8 years ago, I thought for Decatur to be a more progressive community that we should also have some conversations on race. And that is the title of the event that we have now. For 8 years, we've had an event called the Conversation on Race, where we bring together speakers and community people. We've had some national speakers come in. And just to say, I had an honest and open dialogue about race and race relations here in our community. And we've been doing that for 8 years. So I think that's also something that also helps, you know, on the forefront before other, you know, issues happen. So, again, we've been doing that for 8 years. We have juvenile justice meetings. We had one just the other day, and at a time when people can come out and talk about issues with our youth. And so I think, you know, Decatur's been pretty progressive and upfront in trying to address these issues. You know, the conversation on race is not an easy conversation. People have their thoughts about race, but when they come to the table and confronting one another, a lot of times it gets kind of quiet, and people don't really say what they really think, what they really mean. And so it's not an easy conversation, but I think it's a necessary conversation. And when you walk away from a conversation on race, you could be uncomfortable, but I like to say you should be constructively uncomfortable, because maybe you heard some things that you didn't agree with, but yet you, it stirs something in you to say, okay, I see how someone else feels about this. And so we've been doing that for about 8 years also.
Yeah, who comes to those, Jeffrey?
Oh, actually, the conversation on race was a conglomerate between Decatur Public Schools, Richland Community College, Millikan University, and, of course, you know, the community in general. So it's a collaboration of a lot of different people. And to just, again, to talk about, it's a true cross-section of the community to come together to talk about racial issues. And so old, young, it just a lot of different people. And so we do that in hopes that get some kind of understanding. We don't solve all the world's problems in each year, but it's, again, it's an ongoing dialogue, and then we try to also do other things in between time to address this.
What's come out of those discussions?
That sometimes it just comes out that we still don't understand one another. But, again, there's some things that if people can just understand, whether it's like with law enforcement, like I said earlier, I think criticism is not something that everybody likes to have, but sometimes you have to accept criticism, especially constructive criticism, when people think one way. And the main thing is to hear everybody's voice. Sometimes, especially with young people, we don't allow them an opportunity to really voice their concerns and their frustrations, or we discount them. And I think we've been able to do that, bringing young people together. It's just a way of people being able to vent and come away from that with, okay, maybe I heard something I didn't know, didn't understand. And I've had people call me afterwards and say, boy, I really didn't, I hated that person you had speaking because I don't agree with that. But once again, I say you might feel uncomfortable because race is not a comfortable conversation to have. But when you walk away from it, if you can be constructively uncomfortable, I think that helps.
What kind of things make people uncomfortable? I wonder if you can give us an example.
Oh, I don't know. I think in this particular instance with law enforcement, I think they're uncomfortable any time that they looked at as they don't, you know, that they – we had a town hall meeting, Caring Black Men did, with law enforcement. and one of the officers mentioned something about racially profile, we criminally profile. But yet we know, as nationally, attorneys, doctors, you name it, have been African-Americans who have been stopped that they felt like unlawfully. And so it's hard for police to believe that they do have people in their ranks that are doing these things. And when people vent that and tell it, I think they get defensive, and maybe even on the other side, community people, when we know that a lot of people have guns in our neighborhoods and we talk about that, they get defensive. So it's truth, but yet it's being able to accept criticism and understand that there's issues on both sides. And I think people just having a hard time doing that.
Mm-hmm. How does your organization, Caring Black Men of Decatur, fit into this?
Well, again, as I said, we as a matter of fact, we have a program right now with every Thursday at one of the parks here in the inner city, where we bring together young boys, ages maybe 8 to 12, that age group. And we have in the park every Thursday, we have a golf clinic, there's a free lunch, and then there's a baseball clinic, and from 12 to 3 every Thursday. And we also have law enforcement there. The sheriff's office and the Decatur Police Department are there with officers who actually interact with the young men, with the baseball, and we sit and talk during the lunch hour. And we have a group called the Partamers, an African-American golf group that comes in and does the golf clinic. And then we also do a baseball clinic. So it's an opportunity for law enforcement to interact and actually talk with young boys. So hopefully from the time they get 15 or 16 years old, they have a better rapport with law enforcement. Also, Caring Black Men started a program called Pops with Cops, where we have these coupons for these popular Polar Pops that the Circle K, Caring Black Men, and the police department work together with. So as officers would be driving the neighborhoods, they might see young people doing positive things. They would stop them and give them a coupon.
Oh, that's great.
For a free Polar Pop. And once again, most of the time, the interaction with especially young African-American youth is not always positive. They might see the police coming in their house, taking drugs out, guns out, taking uncle or somebody back to jail, that type of thing. So they have a negative perception of police departments. This might be a way of helping them and say, get being stopped and saying, oh, I'm getting a free Polar Pop for doing something positive. And that's an opportunity for the police department to build a better rapport with our youth. And so, and then in the schools every day, Monday through Friday, we do 13 schools and also K through 12. And we see about 250 to 300 boys a week. And we're pushing this thing of character and integrity. And part of the character is the pillars. And the main pillar in this case would be like citizenship, to talk to them about how they act in the schools and also how they act out in the community.
Jeffrey, so, we have less than a minute left. I just want to ask you one last question. As this national conversation is happening, as all of these unfortunate events have unfolded in our country in the past 2 weeks, are you optimistic about Decatur and the work that you were doing? Do you think that things can get better? Do you think they are getting better?
Well, I believe they can get better, yes, because if I didn't, I wouldn't be continuing to do this. But I think it's going to take a lot of work. It's not going to happen overnight. It's going to take consistency and to continue the dialogue and to continue the work that we're doing and not let certain instances deter us to the point where we have violence in our communities and things like that. So I see promise in Decatur, and I think we have so many people, not just Caring Black Men, we have so many people and organizations in our community doing a lot of great things. And so I think all of us working together, is we're going to get the job done.
Thank you for that. Jeffrey Perkins is the founder of Caring Black Men of Decatur. In the interest of full disclosure, he also serves on the Community Advisory Board for Illinois Public Media. Thank you.
So thank you for having me.
Maybe you've noticed a lot of dead trees lately. Actually, it turns out it's not because of the weather, but because of a perfect storm of temperatures, weather conditions, and pests, including the drought back in 2012. Joining us to explain what's going on now is Don White. He's Champaign County's master gardener and also an emeritus professor in plant pathology at the University of Illinois Extension. Professor White, welcome to the 21st. Thank you for taking the time to talk with us. What's been causing so many trees in Illinois to die?
I think what's happened is we're seeing lots and lots and lots of dead and dying trees. it's almost the perfect storm, because what happens is, of course, a lot of the dead ones that we're seeing are emerald ash borer. So we're losing a lot of ash.
So that's an invasive species problem. That's not a drought problem.
And there are just lots of them. Also, the last couple of years, we have lost lots of older, mature trees, including some just beautiful oak trees. And that primarily is due to armillaria root rot. And what happens with this root rot, the fungus lives on the roots of almost all trees that you want to find in a landscape or a forest. And it rots some roots every year, but the host is growing, the tree's growing, and replaces those roots. So it's kind of like the fungus eats a little bit, the tree replaces it. The fungus eats a little bit, tree replaces it. So it's back and forth, back and forth. But we had two very dry years. 2012 was the one that really stood out. And what happened then was the fungus was rotting the roots, but the tree was not growing fast enough to replace them. Then the next year, the tree kind of got behind in its root growth, and the fungus took advantage of that stressed tree and just kept right on rotting.
And so,
we lost.
So we're losing some. So it seems like we're losing some trees because of disease. Do you think that we're also losing trees because of drought, and not obviously this year, but from previous years?
Well, what it is, they're interconnected, because if we had good growing conditions for those drought years, we wouldn't be seeing armillaria root rot rotting and killing as many trees.
Mm.
But the root rot kind of came to be more important because the trees could not replace the roots as fast as they were rotted, and the tree went into stress, and the fungus got the upper hand, and slowly but surely, a lot of them died. And if you remember, after the drought, then we had a very, very cold winter. So that just kind of helped things out, too.
And you mean it made things worse?
Yes. It helped things out from the standpoint of the fungus.
Right. I was going to say, not from the trees. Because what you're saying, so when you say it's a perfect storm, you really do mean that. Because there was a drought that weakened the trees. We had a cold winter, further weakening the trees and kind of allowing all of these disease and invasive, the emerald ash also,
the emerald ash borer was kind of standing by itself.
Right.
It just came in on its own. It would have been a problem no matter what. Also, what we had year before last or so, we had very nice spring weather. And that meant the trees had large xylem vessel diameter. That's the part that conducts the water.
And is that on the leaves?
No, that's in the main trunk and the leaves. The xylem, X-Y-L-E-M, gets larger in diameter, grows bigger, conducts more water. But we also have some wilt diseases, more fungi, that move in the vascular system of the plant. And if you have a big xylem vessel diameter, they move faster. So we had some of those diseases.
Well, and then are you worried about trees across Illinois being in decline? Is this a significant enough thing that you're concerned about it?
Well, actually, this happened also following the drought of 88. 87 was also dry. And then following that, into the early 90s, we lost some trees. Not quite as many as we're losing now, but we did lose trees. So it's just the same thing happens again.
Well, Professor White, I wonder, these are older trees. Certainly we can't grow them fast enough to replace what's dying right now.
Well, the thing of it is, it's not necessarily one age group is dying out. A lot of it has to do with just happen to be where it just happened to be growing and the environment in that one particular location.
Is this a concern? Are we seeing this across central Illinois?
Well, wherever I've been recently driving around, I've seen some large specimen trees that are dead and dying.
What can people do to protect trees right now? Is there anything they can do to protect other trees?
Well, really, it's not a matter of protecting in a way. I guess if you wanted to water during droughts, you could have. But now there's nothing really to be done because we're getting plenty of water now. So if we would have watered a lot during those drought years, it would have helped. I live in the woods, and I water the woods. I guess people think I'm crazy. But I didn't lose as many trees as some people did.
And so is the rule for the future, so people know, and again, obviously not a situation we're in now where we've got plentiful rain. What's a time period when people should be concerned? How long? Is it a couple weeks? If we're not getting rain for a couple weeks, should you be watering trees?
Yeah, it's more like a month.
A month. Okay.
That's really start shoving it over.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us. Don White is a master gardener in Champaign County. He's also an emeritus professor of plant pathology at the University of Illinois Extension, where he's joining us from his office there. Thank you, Professor White.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for today. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.